Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, this is the first of the expanded discussion episodes that we promised with the launch of our Supercast. We'll really quickly, because it's Friday and we took the past 2 days off, go into a quick bit of our pitch before we launch the Supercast fully this upcoming Tuesday. But look, this is happening because a bunch of people already have stepped up to support the show. We're doing more episodes, we're doing more interviews, we're bringing these discussions extra, fitting it, and we're providing a lot of value here. So if this is what you want to support, this is what you actually want to do, that's incredibly important. And the last bit that I'll add here too is we keep hearing from everyone, this isn't just Netflix's problem, that there is just an overwhelming number of subscriptions. So what we are trying to do as much as possible is increase the volume of our content, but also keep it as unpaywalled as humanly possible. The way we can do that is by people just saying, we want to support you, not because we're giving you an extra 15 minutes of exclusive audio, but because actually we think this show, these conversations are valuable. So if you think this is worth it, we'd really appreciate you. Sagar, got anything to add?
Yeah, I think that's the main point, which is, look, I mean, it's not about, you know, I mean, it's not that exclusive content won't be there, but I just think the most important thing is about support and about making sure that we can pay the bills and giving as much independence and editorial authority as possible. Like, I always try to tell people this on Breaking Points too, which is, look, I mean, production costs a lot of money, a lot of the equipment stuff. It may seem, you know, even the most low-tech pods still cost money in order to distribute, and especially to do it right. And to do it right at the highest level costs serious money. So that's just something that I would admire. I would just remind people it's something that is very helpful. I can guarantee you, like, you know, there's no exorbitant spending or whatever on our part. This is literally just to pay.
You're wearing a Kirkland sweatshirt for
I know.
The audio listeners should know that this is not a, right. We're not dripping. We're not Hassan the Hun with his $1,000 Coachella button up shirt. So quick note here, go to the top of your show notes if you want to get the link to subscribe to Supercast and get all the good stuff there. And then once again, these episodes are going to be super audience driven. So this is just getting started. Sagar and I put this one together, but definitely write in at realignmentpod@gmail.com when you want us to talk about specific topics. But today's topic is the most obvious first topic ever. Sagar, I said this before we started the episode, you are the closest you've ever been to being a main character in the Twitter discourse. For those listeners who do not obsessively follow your Twitter, what am I talking about? What's going on? Then we'll get into the bigger picture.
Yeah, so I just pulled it up. It's pretty amusing. So I was just fucking around yesterday, and I saw a Politico story about Vijaya Gadde. So she is the head of trust and safety over at Twitter. You guys will probably remember her from the Joe Rogan podcast, where she appeared alongside Jack to debate Tim Pool. She is probably the single most ardent pusher of censorship within the entire company, no matter how you feel about that, by the way. So if you do like it, then this is your person. If you don't like it, this is your person. This is just an objective statement of fact. Anyway, so the political story came out. Headline, Twitter's top lawyer reassures staff, cries during meeting about Musk takeover. So I screenshotted the headline, and here's what I tweeted. Vijaya Gadde, the top censorship advocate at Twitter, who famously gaslit the world on Joe Rogan's podcast and censored the Hunter Biden laptop story, is very upset about the Elon Musk takeover. All right, that's all I tweeted. A couple hours go by. I don't really think about it. Then check my phone. Phone starts buzzing. It won't stop buzzing. Turns out Elon, the meme god himself, replies. Here's what he says. He says, suspending the Twitter account of a major news organization for publishing a truthful story was obviously incredibly inappropriate. Now, I actually think that's pretty anodyne. I don't really know that many people who disagree with that. I mean, even the most ardent center-left people will be like, yeah, that one was pretty messed up. Okay, so I thought it was over. Then I basically go to sleep. You know, yeah, everyone's like, oh my God, you got replied to by Musk. But it's like, yeah, whatever. All right, so I wake up. Turns out the Washington Post and all of these other outlets, including Business Insider, The Atlantic, The New York Times, have all written up Elon's exchange with me. And the crux of those exchanges is that Elon and me are somehow responsible for harassment against Vijaya Gadde because some random ass Twitter accounts tweeted some racist stuff at her. Now, I guess it obviously has to be said that I don't condone that, but the crux of the articles that they are writing about Elon and myself are that we are responsible for the racism against her because we dared to criticize her. And to add insult to injury, the Washington Post, in their article, which I was reading for my job, I noticed a line inside of it which said, Engedi did not respond to a request for comment. And I was like, oh, well, that is complete bullshit because I always reply to requests for comment. I'm actually pretty accessible to a lot of these MSM reporters. I used to work with a lot of them, and a lot of them know me, a lot of them have my phone number. And so I DM'd the author and I was like, hey, look, I don't particularly care, but this is complete bullshit. You can't say that you contacted me for comment. She says she contacted my producer, James. So I asked my producer, Jay, I said, hey, did this email come in? So everybody get this. I get an email, or James gets an email at 2 a.m.
One quick thing, let's be precise. Yeah. Your 22-year-old producer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gets an email. This isn't not me. But not just that, but like, this isn't James's job. James's job is not to be a 24/7 PR person.
That's
must be very precise about that.
Yeah. So yeah, this is not even in his job description. So, okay. So here's what she writes. Quote, she says, request for comment from Mr. Engedi about tonight's tweets from the Washington Post. This is set at 2:06 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Hi there. We are writing up his tweets tonight about Vijayagade with the peg that Musk is piling onto some of them. Some questions. Does he have any concern that mentioning a specific Twitter executive could result in attacks on that exec? What are their responsibilities there? For example, one of the commenters on the tweets made racist comments about her. Others said she'd be fired. What does he hope to accomplish by getting Gade and getting Elon involved? So there's a lot going on there. Number one,
Give your editorial because I want to actually work through a couple of the questions. This is your space, please.
Number one, bullshit to ask for comment at 2 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Bullshit. Everybody knows that that's a ridiculous tactic. Number two, as I wrote in my response, the Twitter executive, Vijaya, who I mentioned, it went on the Joe Rogan Experience. She's the head of policy at Twitter. She is a public figure. My criticism of her is about policy. It didn't have anything to do with her race. It had nothing to do with her persona at all. I don't really know anything about her. I've never met her before. Now, number two, the idea that I was getting Elon involved is crazy. I tag the guy. I tag any public figure who I talk about. That's normal. He replied to it. I didn't know he was going to reply to it. What was I hoping to accomplish? There's no nefarious plot here. I was just tweeting. I don't like Vijayagade. It's true. Okay. I hate that woman. I saw her on Joe Rogan. I said, she's a censorship snake. I've thought it for 4 years. Marshall, I've complained to you about her way before I ever started Breaking Points and all of this. So, you know, I just think it's this is what I said. I said, this is a perfect example of how the media smears you. I make a substantive point. The randos say something. Now, me and Elon apparently are racist and responsible for all of these people. And it's all to cover up the fact that they substantively just agree with a lot of the censorship. So there you go. That's all my editorial.
Yeah. luckily for us and for everyone involved, you did not say censorship snake in the original tweet. But I think that gets to the actual point, which is...
But I do think she is one. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, which now that we're post-stopping. But that's the key thing. It wasn't... You were not as aggressive as you are here, Cody. So I want to actually engage with her questions because I think that they directionally are helpful to something that's super important right now, which is, hey, wait, like actually, how should Twitter work? Because it seems like what Musk is arguing for when it comes to Twitter is that his version of Twitter is going to be one that's much more determined by individual users and expectations and culture and rely much less on refs coming down from above making these aggressive statements. So number one, because I think it's really important that you and I think about these standards and other people think about them too, because then they organically can come together and form what the new normal be. One, like you said, public figure. Mm-hmm. You are not searching out for some random intern who was on the policy team 3 years ago and was tangentially related to something that you'd done. This was the, you know, top legal person who's
still
down the Joe Rogan experience.
Yeah.
But in terms of what the comments you were referencing, right? This was, you know, at the height of power of Twitter. You are referencing my personal perspective is once you go on the Joe Rogan experience, if there ever was a qualifier of public figure, that'd really be it. I think it's really important that we think of this idea of just civilians. This isn't a random engineer. This isn't a random person who had thoughts and feelings. Like, this is actually a person there. So for her to say that you invoking the name represented an actual harassment adjacent thing. She doesn't quite accuse you, but it's kind of amorphous and in a frankly dangerous way for your reputation. That is basically telling you that you need to shut up. Given the standards that she laid out there, the only possible way that there could be a zero chance of a troll or a bot or someone in bad faith getting in her mentions would be you just did not say anything. Mm-hmm. And what I'll say to folks at Twitter, because once again, like Sagar and I disagree on these issues a decent amount. I'd say I'm much more moderate slash sympathetic to the Twitter crowd. But what I just have to say is, and by Twitter crowd, I mean Twitter employees, when you frame things this way, and when your opinion on this topic is expressed this manner by a friendly reporter, this is why you've lost this battle. I mean, this is what I've been really struck by. I've been just struck by the fact that it seems very clear it's so many folks who are in favor of maintaining the status quo at Twitter, what they would call moderation, safety, what you would call censorship, they have just been unable to actually, I think, win in a fair fight. It's been lots of this, like, I don't know about you, Gil, but I've just felt this weird semblance of, are they just waiting for a magical referee to come? Is someone just hoping that if someone calls you racist, someone will come down and be like, all right, Sagar, that's it. You're done. Yeah. That just doesn't exist there. And actually, if anything, Elon's whole articulation of how things are changing is that he will not be that person. So what I'd really ask Twitter folks and people who disagree with you, Sagar, is, hey, actually get good at making arguments that do not rely on attacking the personal character or even just like the underlying weird assumptions of what's actually going on.
But that's what I'm saying, man. Nobody disagrees with my point on the Hunter Biden laptop story, except the Biden campaign. They're never going to engage with that. You can't defend it, period. The trans stuff, maybe.
Here's the quick defense. Yeah. I want to know what you think about this. The quick defense is, at the height of the moment, there was a lack of understanding of what the thing actually represented. Come on, you know this.
That's a bullshit point. Because it's not applied equally. That's the whole point. That's the reason.
That's a different argument, though. So if the argument is, okay, there is such thing as foreign actors, there is such thing as election interference, we are going to rigorously police that from any direction, that is different than...
I would disagree with that, but it's still different. And that's why, which is that it's a haphazard bullshit policy, which was put into place. It's not real. Their hacked materials policy was made up and then changed on the exact same day. A lot of people forget the chronology of all of this. They made up the hacked materials policy. And then Vijaya herself is the one who amended the policy on that day, because all of this at the time was still saying that this was hacked information, even though the reporting itself said that that was not true.
Wait, what do you mean by, be precise, what do you mean by made up? Like, this is actually helpful.
Okay. This is what people need to know, which is that the Post story came out. Then Twitter came out and said, this is in violation of our hacked materials policy. There was no previously published hacked materials policy. Then what happened is that Jack found out about the decision, reversed the decision, and changed the quote unquote hacked materials policy, which was then put out later that day by Vijaya Gadde herself. So, like, this is the point that I'm trying to make. Look, if they had an actual, by the way, by this standard, they should have banned, there's all kinds of different stuff.
Let's talk about that too. Like, so, because I think what's interesting to me is, like, I think there's actually a pretty good faith case for a hacked materials policy that's implemented in good faith.
I don't even think that, because, like I said, I just believe so much in the public figure standard above all. WikiLeaks, obviously stolen emails. It's in the public consciousness, has to be allowed. If it concerns public figures, Even if it's stolen information, so be it. Pentagon Papers were technically stolen, right? That's always the one that everybody goes and talks back to. So I have a public interest threshold, basically like a public figure threshold. So okay. For example, if you're a private citizen and your phone gets hacked by your boyfriend and ex-boyfriend or whatever is tweeting out like your nude images. Actually, that one's so
that's illegal. That's actually illegal in a lot.
Let's say your boyfriend is tweeting out screenshots of your text messages. Yeah, I think that should be able to be taken down for personal harassment because you're a civilian. But like you're Hillary Clinton, I think it's bad that the Russians hacked you. But like, look, whatever's in your emails is in the public interest. A lot of stolen information in the past has been very much in the public interest. So that's why I just completely am against. Well, that's why I think the policy was BS.
I want to build one thing here, which is where there is not enough. I think folks at Twitter, especially in that moment, cannot be racked over the coals of this enough. Once again, you disagree with a lot of what you just said, but on the fly, you were like, okay, here's this standard. Here are these different bits. I have no indication. I don't think you do either. If anyone does, Twitter was having those sorts of conversations.
No, yeah.
I think that's what my huge point of frustration is with the folks who are defending the status quo at Twitter, which is that at this point, let's put aside the fact that the business model wasn't working out that well. There was very little actual public confidence that this is and was a company that had its stuff together, that was equipped to say, okay, so perfect example, Sagar. So for example, your key claim here was they made up the hacked materials policy on the fly. Do you know what no one would ever believe? Them saying, no, okay, look, we didn't technically write it down, but we all know there was something there. There was nothing there. That is my point here. Like there was not a articulation of the Pentagon Papers reference you just made, the delineation between the jilted ex-boyfriend and let's say the laptop person who had Hunter Biden's laptop. The key thing here is that there is so little first principles thinking when it came to these issues that inevitably leads to, as you started this off with, unfair apportionment to different areas. Wait, WikiLeaks is cool, but that isn't cool. I mean, Snowden literally fled to Russia and China. Talk about foreign interference. Seriously, if the Hunter Biden thing is bad, regardless of how any of you feels about this, obviously WikiLeaks would have been in total violation of policy too.
Yeah, exactly. No, that the Snowden one is another good example. That was clearly stolen, hacked material. Okay. I mean, so be it. By the way, if you're mad about WikiLeaks in 2016, you were probably cool with the WikiLeaks that Chelsea Manning stole in 2007. And with those Iraq war videos, that's the point, which is that you should have a public interest standard and then we can talk about it and we can debate it. That's, this is just really not difficult in order to articulate. And, actually, this is another thing which I think should be discussed. So the current tech press is very upset, Marshall, that people are not blaming Jack Dorsey enough. And I think we should actually talk about this. Okay. Because it's very clear to me that Jack was not the guy who was running the show. Now, by the way, he's still responsible. And that is an indictment of Jack and his leadership for the fact that he was in like Indonesia whenever the Trump tweet or the Hunter Biden thing got taken down. He literally had two jobs. He worked from home. I think he only worked two full days a week actually at Twitter.
So he's clearly an absentee. Because remember, for folks who missed this discourse, he at the time was also CEO of Square, not called Block, given his interest in crypto and those issues, he clearly had much more of his actual heart invested.
And I think
also the company was worth much more than Twitter is.
I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, the bulk of his net worth also came from Square.
Correct.
So that was also important. Anyway, I'm not saying I don't blame Jack. That being said, from Jack's appearance on the Rogan Experience and any other interaction I've ever had with the guy on top of the interviews, it's very clear to me that Jack genuinely did believe in a free speech standard. But, and this actually gets to the very core of the company, which is that Twitter's core problem has always been rudderless, and it was never really owned or started by one person. There was no Larry or Sergey who had outsized voting power and shares to control the company even whenever it was public. So it was constantly getting back and forth with different CEOs. Jack himself only owned like 2% of the company, really didn't have a lot of sway. So over the years, you have this like amalgamation of team where even though he's technically the CEO, he does not run the show. And Vijaya really comes forward as like the character to embody and defend the trust and safety, the trust and safety policy, which ends up, you know, that's when you really start to see the censorship regime really kick into high gear from 2015 onward. And this is where I genuinely do think Jack is not to blame here. Like when you consider
he's responsible.
Yes.
Like that is
but
the word
not to blame, right? So okay. Like that's, I think that's a key delineator. And all of this is very clear to me that they think it's BS that Vijaya herself is getting targeted for this. And like, it's just so, it's clear as day. I'm like, you are the party who was responsible. Like I said, I believe that is an indictment of Jack's leadership, but you are the one who did it. Like we all know that. So I don't know why criticism of her is so out of bounds.
Well, here's what's interesting. What I was thinking about the whole time, and this actually speaks to why Elon, despite the drawbacks that he obviously brings to the table, I think will be a better leader, owner of Twitter than Jack could have, which is that Elon clearly has a much more directed vision of what he wants. Of what he wants Twitter to be. You know, during our first discussion episode, I said, look, guys, stop thinking about Twitter as a tech company. Think about it as a newspaper in the same way that Jeff Bezos thinks of the Washington Post as having a specific ideology. Twitter, by definition, has a very specific ideology when it comes to how does it conceive of itself? What threats to the seat of the space that it's in? What is its broader context? And I think that point resonated with people. Ironically enough, our friend Jason Wilk quoted me in the Washington Post as making that point from this podcast. Is it resonated because it expresses the fact that the leader or the owner of Twitter needs to have a vision. And I think the reason why Vijaya is so interesting here and needs to be in the discourse is because she actually had a pretty concerted vision.
Oh, yeah. She has a vision.
Yeah. The dunk for me on Jack isn't just that they were very poor. Your average MBA grad could have taken apart how bad of a business structure this is. Something like, hey, guys, like maybe not two companies. Like, hey, like it's the 2020 election. It's the Super Bowl for us. Maybe you be in the U.S. at least. Maybe even Alaska, not Asia, not the Pacific, no vacations. But the thing is, once again, the thing that people always say is, look, Jack used to be the person who said that Twitter saw itself as the free speech wing of the free speech party. That, I think, given the technical and business challenges and, frankly, the leadership challenges, let's not forget, Jack got kicked out of Twitter. He came back to Twitter. This was kind of set in the middle of all of that. His articulation of Twitter being that place wasn't sustainable. What he and he honestly moved on from that to a certain degree. What he failed to do is come up with his own articulation, or even I think in his own head, vision for what it actually is. So Vijaya has a very specific vision of what Twitter is, and Elon has a very specific vision, and these two visions I think are diametrically opposed. They do not see the same threats. They don't see the same purposes. They have different interpretations of the rule of government. And guess what? That's actually a good thing. Like, this is actually the fight and the debate that should be had right now. And once again, it's very much to the discredit of folks who support Vijaya that rather than focus on articulating why her vision won't just like hypothetically be better, because let's get real for a second. I don't know what disinformation, like I know what disinformation means, but like the way it's being bandied about on Twitter, I actually don't know what it
means. No, we know what it means. We know it means what the Washington Post says it means. We know what the fact check industrial complex and the Ben Collins and the Taylor Lorenzes say is disinformation. That's what it functionally means. It doesn't have a real definition, right?
So that's my point there is just to finish the point, because the point then is, at a pure politics level, the level I think you and I are both interested in this in, the fact that they have not figured out that that argument is not winning hearts and minds is just kind of like shocking to me.
Yeah,
it's like, guys, like let's just say they're entirely correct, right? Let's say every single thing that Taylor Wren says is right. It doesn't matter because no one agrees with her. no one right. And not, no, right. There are plenty of people who agree with her, but Ewang, the person who bought the company, doesn't believe it. A lot of people who organically support Ewang don't believe it. You don't believe it. I kind of half and kind of half don't believe it. There's no consensus there, and the inability to actually just make good faith cases about saying, well, racist thing, well, harassment thing, well, the executive who got bullied is a woman and this is going to always happen, when actually an executive who was also attacked was a man. He was literally like at the top of the FBI. So it's just sort of like, whoa. And also there's this tweet that you brought up on I need to read this tweet and then I'll let you go, because I want you to respond to this tweet because it actually speaks to the genuine issue that we're really just basically sorting through, which is, so this is from Michael. I'm not gonna say his last name so we don't get accused of anything. I think we'll look back on the last decade as a time when social media gave previously marginalized groups the ability to speak directly to elites, and as a result elites lost their minds. You said in our chat, imagine believing this. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a great tweet, right? Because what it gets at is they have a vision in their mind that the marginalized voices that they consider actually marginalized, so let's remember that also, right? That those voices are so intolerable to the rest of the elites that the elites themselves are then what lost it. Whereas to me, it's actually a reverse story, which is that we'll look back on the last decade as when social media gave us the view of just how deranged most of the elites are, and that as a result, the rest of the country lost its mind. So I would flip it, actually. I would say, okay, for example, how many normal people do you know who are freaked out? Okay, let's say you don't even believe Libs of TikTok thing is a phenomenon, which I do, or critical race theory or one of these other things. That is purely sparked because of elite discourse on Twitter as a result of populist backlashes against these culturally elite phenomena. So I just think it's a fascinating thing in order to look at that and not see like with the way the power flows. I think, Marshall, you said something. Remember the Jim Jordan tweet that people were making fun of?
Oh, yeah.
People were making fun of Jim Jordan.
This is for listeners. I just rewatched Zoolander. So I love any chance to get a 2001 Mugatu reference. And like, I actually feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Yeah. I will doom scroll Twitter and just like pull my hair out. And I don't tweet, so I'm not entering into the dunk discourse. But Jim Jordan, so, you know, representative of Ohio, I'd probably say, Sagar, you and I disagree with him on pretty much everything you could possibly imagine. He tweets, liberals control Hollywood, tech, corporate America, higher education, just basically every single elite, the media, every single thing you could imagine. And he got hardcore ratioed for that. And the thing that makes me go crazy when I see that tweet is, guys, look, listeners, you know me, I'm pretty centrist. There are some weeks where I pretty clearly am pretty center left. There was a funny tweet fight in the YouTube comments section where someone was like, I love how like ephemeral and like kind of like it's not clear where Marshall stands, and it makes him such a great interviewer. And someone goes, what are you talking about? He's like a pretty intelligent center left Democrat most of the time. It's pretty straightforward. So once again, when I have that sort of background and I say the following, it really speaks to how insane this is. Guys, liberal center left to progressive people do control these institutions. Like, the central issue of our era and one of the central issues driving the populist backlash is the education gap. The fact that, like, once again, this is a crazy point because it makes no sense in today's politics. Ronald Reagan won college grads. He did incredibly well if people went to graduate school. It is now the complete opposite today. One of the defining parts of this political realignment that, Sagar, you and I are a little more skeptical on in some parts, but one part that has played through is that Democrats, liberals, the left, progressive, pick whatever word you want to basically use, have increasingly skewed towards those people who have more education. Now, if you have more education, looking at the categories he was describing, media, technology, higher education, literally in the name right there. All of those different systems, they obviously are skewed towards leadership of folks who actually have that education. So by definition, under a society which is increasingly bifurcating towards people with college and graduate school degrees, it's not a shocker that most institutions that wield non-governmental power are going to be controlled by the left, are going to be controlled by liberals, are going to be controlled by center-left people. I'm not meaning this pejoratively. What I want people who are on the left-leaning part of this audience to understand is that you should not take that statement as an insult. You should not take that as something that's meant to be rebutted. I think you should accept it as a truth that needs to reflect the reality. So, for example, if you are a person who is ticked off at the fact that higher education in this country has been terribly mismanaged and how the prices have gone up, the services are down, the outcomes are weaker than ever, the people responsible for that are probably center left. They are not right wing MAGA people. This is just a true fact. So my takeaway there is, if you're center left, you don't need to be saying, well, no, it's not actually true. Like, I could think of this one specific businessman who didn't go to college, but then like got acquired and now leads a tech company. That's not the point. Like, we're talking actually like in 80-20 principle here. So I think that's my real reaction here, which is, look, like, center left, liberals, leftists, progressives, just own it and do better, because that's what you have control over. Because once again, there is not a, yes, I'm sure there is some cringe, weird, Southern Christian evangelical university. Liberty.
I was going to say, there's Liberty, like one
Liberty,
left.
Liberty University, that is not on the center left. Look up what I'm referencing. Outside of a very specific, let's say, 50
schools.
There's
one Republican professor at this one school.
What's your response to that, to this idea?
Yeah, I just think, exactly. Like, just say it. Just be like, you know, Derek Thompson had a great tweet where he talked about how institutional trust amongst all Republicans has fallen, and that the great divider is now going to be education and institutional trust. So if you trust institutions or believe in institutions, you're probably going to be a Democrat or a center-left person. And if you don't, you'll probably be a Republican or a center-right person. And I don't know why people can't just adjust to the reality that we don't live in 1995 anymore. It's like, if you're an institutionalist, you're mostly a Democrat. If you're an anti-institutionalist, then you're mostly a Republican. Or beyond Republican, you are nominally center-right. You don't have to call yourself a Republican. You can hate the Republicans. But the coalition that separates or that combines you with all these other people who mostly vote Republican are people who don't like institutions. And also, it makes a lot of sense that the educated class is going to be the institutional party. And actually, as the further sorting happens, it creates a magnetic effect where anybody who's center-right who believes in institutions will nominally become center-left, and then vice versa. It's like,
this
I don't know why people never, can't
this
just...
Explains, this explains the never-Trumpers. Like, this, yeah, is, right. this is... The key thing is, like, obviously, we, especially during these discussion episodes, you and I both get heated, but audience, this is an empirical phenomenon that we are describing. This is assortative mating. This is moving to super zip codes. Like, this is a very basic fact. And once again, it's something that people need to just be increasingly comfortable. And look, I think part of the issue too, sorry, you're asking like, why is this so hard to understand? Mm-hmm. Last time there was a political realignment was the 1960s, right? So if you are a baby boomer, I'm not saying boomer because I'm not meaning this disparagingly. If you are a baby boomer or a late stage or early stage Gen Xer, like someone like President Obama directionally is, so much of your understanding of what it means to be liberal and on the left is I'm rebelling against authority. So for me, I think the reason why this is so hard to take, especially for older center left to progressive people, is that when they hear the word institution, they think, but wait a second, like my conception of why I'm liberal is that we were pushing back against institutions in the 1990s. We were the ones who were protesting the World Trade Organization. We were the ones saying, screw McDonald, you know, we're talking about jihad versus McWorld, all these different bits. And I have deep sympathy for you. But at the end of the day, what happens during a political realignment is the terms and the ideas and the frames and frankly, even the issues at hand come about. So you know what? Actually, here's the way that I'll put it. Now there's this discourse of, guys, like, what happened? Like, free speech used to be a thing of the left, and now it's a right-wing thing. This is crazy. My story perfectly agree with that take, but that's a take you're seeing on Twitter right now. The best way to think about this isn't thinking of it as free speech, but rather issues that are raised by free speech. For example, what were the issues in the 1960s? The issues were, there were radical campus protests. Ronald Reagan is president, is the governor of California, and he, as part of his governing agenda, cracks down on protesters. He cracks down on speech. He very much rides the pushback to the backlash of the 1960s to be a very law and order type person. Also, Richard Nixon is president. So when it came to the questions of that moment, aka the state versus universities, you know, I'm from Oregon, the University of Oregon. There's the main quad leads to the EMU, which is the Memorial Union Student Hall. There's literally, it's designed in a manner so that like police trucks can get to the center of campus to fight back against, campus protests. So the real point here is the issues that we're debating right now are different than the issues of the 60s. So what you have to recognize is, look, like, you know, maybe I was an anti-institutionalist when it came to the 1960s, but how do I actually feel about the issues of today? How do I think about content moderation? What do I think about the word censorship? Do I think that disinformation is the greatest threat of the time, or is top-down control the threat of our time? Those are value-based judgments, which I could see both sides on, but you should understand that's a different set and not get stuck in the past.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Marshall. I mean, look, like you said, I think you're correct. Most people are just really not used. There's so many brain-dead people who still think we're living in 1998. And I just don't know how you can experience American politics today and legitimately think that. Like, how
what
can
is
you,
what is, you said, what is 1998?
Like you
what
just said, I mean, in the idea, okay, in the center left was not nominally power, or was not the dominant power base in 1998. They were in the elite structure, but they were still cowed by the Republican majority and the moral majority, because the country was a lot more center right on social issues. Then the internet happened and the entire country changed. 9/11, trade, everybody's heard the spiel, okay? Like, we get it. 9/11, Iraq, trade, you know, financial crisis,
what
Obama,
China,
Trump,
and it's crazy.
Immigration, China, okay, all right. The whole country's different. It's a different country. Thus, we have different politics. It's just such a basic concept to me. But people, like you said, man, like, people are so unable and unwilling to see that the new coalitions have nothing to do with the policy positions, with ideology. They are purely a matter of whether and how you feel about institutions, which is mostly approximated by education. And that's okay. That's completely okay.
80-20.
And it has structural problems for both sides.
But there's big ones, yeah.
Right, right.
This is why, and the structural problem for the right is this is why the Trump administration was a shit show, which is that the number of pure, another way of saying deep state is just like competent, credentialed people who can run things versus weird grifters that you met on Twitter who then you put in government position, right? It goes both directions, and it's a important issue. But for the last big topic I want to hit, because there's one that really resonated with me, I want to talk about Biden's student loan issue, because it perfectly is downstream from the divides within Twitter and social media, and frankly, the class one we were talking about, class in education one we were just talking about. So what's happened here is that you have had a literal pause on federal student loan payments since the coronavirus hit. This started by a Trump admin executive order. Then when the CARES Act passed a month into COVID, it was then instituted. The Biden administration has consistently pushed back the date by which student loan payments have to resume. And another key thing too, it's not merely that the student loan payments are being paid, it's that actually you literally have a pause on interest. So the lack of payment isn't costing anyone anything. And Joe Biden, I think to his credit, because Joe Biden is actually on a good day, I think closer to whatever the centrist consensus of the country is, has always been reluctant to go all in on student debt forgiveness. However, as his party and his presidency continues to really struggle with the ability to attract and enthuse and make young voters enthusiastic, you're actually seeing he openly said to Democratic politicians this week that he and his administration are looking into a way to forgive some, if not all, of the Federalist Student Loan Debt. So Sagar, I know you're going to have a take on this. I'd love to hear your reaction to this entire issue.
Yeah, I mean, well, what do you mean exactly? Let me
do one thing too, which is, this is my center left side. It's really important to note that Sagar, you and I have not 1 cent of student debt. Mm-hmm. It's important that we check our privilege, but it actually is, because nothing is more boomer con than saying, well, you know, when I was a kid, I worked really hard during summer. Right.
Student debt ruins lives. But and if you don't know that, you're an idiot.
I can't imagine, your and my entire history is we weren't happy with what we were doing. We took a gamble. On trains, moved to DC and interned for our first year. I do not know how you do that the way we did it.
Not possible.
If you have student debt or don't have family support. So I think people who hold the position that you and I directionally hold are way too insensitive when it comes to that. So here's basically what I'm asking you. How should the Biden administration approach this challenge of the loan payments being stopped and just continually doing it, moving back and back and back? What do you think?
I don't know. They're in a real pickle. Yeah. Here's the thing. I just think that canceling student debt without dealing with the structural university system is bullshit and is rightfully going to be dramatically politically unpopular. And it is going to be, here's the other, okay, let's start again with the coalitions. And it, like you just said, you know that there are more working class young people in this country who didn't go to college than who did go to college. So now you're bailing out your own voters. Let's be very specific about who exactly these people are. You're not dealing with the universities, another independent power base of your support, who wrongfully bankrupted many of these people and overcharged them. You're not dealing with the funding structure for any of this, and you're not making it an appeal to all Americans. So I've said this before. I do not support any debt cancellation for student debt unless it is dealt with structural reforms in the university system. And I think this also is to be clear, I cannot support that without an opportunity wipe out of debt for a commiserate number of young people on either the credit card side, the auto side, or some other one. Because I believe in universal policies. So I think that a student debt is holding down a lot of young people. But like I said, I think something 55, maybe 60% of young people in this country did not go to college. But they have a lot of debt too, by the way. They have auto loans. They pay a lot of taxes too.
This is what's actually important to understand structurally. This isn't just like you wipe stuff off the balance sheet.
Yeah.
This isn't like fake paper money. Like, this is real money. So if this debt is forgiven, like, it's actually fascinating. You know this, the New York Times did a great episode on this. Like, shout out to The Daily for being good at what The Times is actually good at, which is straightforward. It's like a CNN, right? When they just do reporting, they're very good at it. The government's paying like $5 billion a month in missed interest since 2020. That's a lot of money that people are operationally paying for. So I think you just hit something which is very important that I want listeners to draw out on, because we're going to get a lot of pushback, but also a lot of folks write in whenever we talk about this issue. They say they didn't know this. I hate when people who hold our positions, aka work in media and shape discourse, just generically refer to the student debt crisis like as a crisis. Because I don't actually. So here's the thing. Maybe it's possible it's a crisis, but from what I can tell, what's really happening here is there are specific problems and interests that affect people who work, let's say, in media. So once again, media, this is not a lucrative job. So, I mean, this is, I mean, look, dude, you and I come from families who have PhDs. Mm-hmm. Most people we know who work in media are not coming from, super tough. No, I don't want to even, that's unfair to say. I'm not going to overstate that. But like the vast majority of people
in media are people who come from privileged backgrounds. That's just objectively true.
And a result of that is that media jobs tend to be very, very, very low paid. Yeah. So what happens there is that you have a lot of people who are making 35, 45K, which say like working for Vox or working at a second, third tier publication, who actually don't come from family money or have debt. For them, they're paying crazy amounts of money to go to school. They're making very little money in professions that are frankly structured around upper middle class people. So then they're writing headlines like student debt crisis. But you know what they don't really have? They don't have lots of credit card debt. They don't have lots of auto debt. They probably live in a big coastal city where they don't even drive in the first place. They don't have a mortgage, so there's no mortgage debt. If you actually, it's true that college debt has exceeded other forms of debt for the first time, but not by much. Like, we're still talking trillions and trillions of dollars. So the thing that I'm so obsessed with, like, Sagar, you're saying your goal is universal policies. Mm-hmm. My goal is I want consensus-based policies, not merely narrative-driven ones. So I want us as a society to come to the conclusion, look, here is the hierarchy of debt. We think that actually forgiving 10K of credit card debt from everyone is a higher priority than forgiving 10K of student loan debt. Maybe it goes differently, but I think the key thing, and this is what we're lacking on at a political class issue, is that a talented political class wouldn't just recite generic narratives that they hear in the media or that make their base excited. They would see the opportunity as people get more and more tired of the bases on the far left and the far right to say, like, wait, guys, like, what do you actually think? Like, actually, okay, question for the audience, write in. RealignmentPod@gmail.com or come on the Substack. What is, like, the top most important level of debt that needs to be addressed from a fairness perspective? Let's just posit we are going to do something as a society, as a government level. Like, what is your highest priority? But yeah, Sagar, go on.
I think it's probably credit card debt. That's probably the one that people, I mean, you know, people in this country have a lot of debt, man. Yeah. But, you know, the other thing, I don't know. It's just so hard because, look, to be honest, in a lot of these environments too, right now, doing these policies in a non-inflationary way is just so difficult. Because
explain what you mean by that.
If you forgive a bunch of student loan debt, I mean, you're going to see an explosion of spending kind of by the elite class. And look, I'm not like a deficit boomer, okay? But like that is basic economics. So like what I would say, when this is gets to the multifaceted nature of this problem, is that any sort of universal debt cancellation would also have to be paired with attacking the core supply side problems in inflation so that we could also meet the commensurate demand spike that's going to happen as a result of people having more money to spend, which isn't going notably to the card and debt services. But I just think in general, it's a stupid policy. And look, a lot of people who are going to hold student debt may be angry when they're listening to this. Probably actually podcast listeners are disproportionately more likely to have a college degree. So sorry, everyone. But you guys got to think about it in the context of good politics. Like, do you really, really, really want both boomers who genuinely are against student debt cancellation and also working class young people who don't have any student debt, who pay taxes and who are getting destroyed by inflation right now, to be united in the fact that this was an unfair bailout? Because also, here's the other one. The Biden debt cancellation is on shaky legal ground. It's almost certainly going to get challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court. There's already a conservative Supreme Court, right? So we don't really know that this would even pass muster unless it's an act of Congress. And so something I really learned in the Trump years was that a shitty version of an executive action could actually neuter the possibility of something passing in the legislature as a result of turning the populace against it, if that makes sense.
No, that perfectly explains the 2017 immigration executive order story. So, you know, this in our last 2 minutes here, but I was talking about my position on this, which is, look, the Biden problem is as follows. Things are bad with young people. The headline they do not want at a political sympathy level is Biden resumes payment. Forgive 10K. Universally, just say basically, look. But
even 10K, Marshall, it's not fair. It's just not fair. You can't give some people $10,000.
But they're already giving it though. So this is the thing. Sorry.
Yeah, fair.
They've already paused the interest payments, which once again is $5 billion. Like, it's so much money. So just say, look, guys, there's a social contract. You took on the debt. We're going to work to fix this system. We're going to resume payments. But in recognition of how crazy the situation is, we're going to forgive 10K in debt. I also think the people who I want student debt forgiveness for, just like, I totally just believe this, people who didn't graduate from college. So the people who are most screwed under the current system are not obviously people who got a JD law degree and have 200K in debt. It's a person who went to a mediocre third tier private or state university, took out way too much debt, and is working a job that, and then once again, didn't graduate and is now working a job that they could have gotten without even going to college in the first place. We should basically take that old timey, like women and children into the lifeboats first idea and apply it to this situation. If we can agree there's this massive problem and there's this huge percentage of people in our generation who are totally screwed, we have to start with people that are actually screwed. And someone who's actually screwed right now is someone who went to college for 5 years, took out loans they shouldn't have taken out, are not benefiting from that degree, and are terrified of the loan payments with the interest resuming. They have to be targeted first. And talk about so much of a simpler... Oh, and then to your point, Sagar, you then attack it with a universalist, this is why the system's going to be better bit. We're in our last minute, so like, just give your closing take. And it's a frustrating topic.
It's very frustrating because it's just been boiled down to something which is just not real, like you said. And I just think a lot of it is just the freak out of a professional managerial class who want to turn themselves into class victims. Like, here's the thing too. You know, you were talking about debt. $10,000 takes care of the most onerous debt for a lot of people. The people who care the most about 10 to 60K or 100K, they all have master's degrees. So like, now we're talking about bailing out the most elite of the elite. And I don't mean that in terms of money. I mean, in terms of cultural cachet. And by the way, I'm there with you. I have a master's degree. I'm not, I'm a member of this class. I'm just saying though, that politically, that's a nightmare situation. You should always think about policy, not just for yourself, but in the context of how it's going to affect everybody. And also, even if you do want that policy selfishly, what's the best way to make it politically sustainable? Because I can guarantee you the most unpopular president of my lifetime making this happen is not good for you.
And last thing here, because I want to bring up your universalist point. The other problem that I'm noticing here is that there is very little articulation from anybody in the Biden team. I'm not talking to Democratic socialists who've been serious on this issue, of why doing this forgiveness makes America a better place. Think of the GI Bill. The GI Bill, it's passed during World War II. It's a generation of white people. Right, let's acknowledge the fact that it was not equitable, as many New Deal programs were not. But the idea was, hey, like as a society, if we help veterans get educated, we will all benefit. And the fact that Biden is letting it all be said that this is being done to win an election is a disaster for the policy. And like you said, Sagar, is not what you want to see. So everyone, that is our the wrap on our first official discussion back and forth episode. We're doing this every 2 weeks. We want to hear your takes, so write in, check the Substack, do all those things. And we'll be doing the interviews in the week too. But this is a great way to supplement what we're doing with the show and we expand our content. So once again, we'd love for you to check out our Supercast and throw us 550, let's say even 500, if you've got the cash flow to support our work.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.